Opium. Potent and evocative. It is a word with the power to intoxicate both speaker and listener. A word that implies languor, mystery, and a sort of sinister beauty. Nothing seems to capture the sensuousness of this word better than the image of the dreamy smoker adrift in his illicit paradise. Aside from the opium, he has few needs. A place to recline in the comforting proximity of fellow habitués. Lost in a cloud of visions, inseparable from his pipe, released from the cares and worries of everyday life, he has chosen opium to be his faithful friend, his lifelong companion. But this hedonistic picture has faded into the past, for although opium smoking still exists in isolated communities, the 19th century fashion, or epidemic as some have called it, that alarmed governments and citizens for almost a century, has all but died away. Possibly one of the most versatile drugs known thanks to its principal active ingredient, morphine. Opium deadens pain, produces elation, induces sleep, and reduces distress. In the long history of opium use around the world, people in search of euphoria and well-being have managed to introduce opium and its derivatives into the body in every way imaginable. In addition to being smoked, it has been drunk, eaten, sniffed, rubbed on, and injected. Whereas the opium smoker inhales the drug's vapors using a pipe specifically designed for the purpose, the opium eater drank it, usually in the form of laudanum, an opium alcohol mixture. The true opium eater ingested it in the form of small pills, often mixed with substances that disguised the bitter taste. In the 19th century, opium was the prime ingredient in countless numbers of patent medicines that were used to quiet crying babies, calm frayed nerves, and restore a semblance of health to millions. Thomas De Quincey, author of the legendary Confessions of an Opium Eater, remarked that unlike wine, which provides a flickering flame of pleasure, opium gives a steady and equable glow. In those days, opium was called a stimulant, a term then used to describe something that produced a state of well-being, and not, as it is understood today, a state of excitement. Lewis Lewin, in his 1931 book Fantastica, correctly identified opiates as drugs that sedated mental activity and classified them as euphorica. Today, opium is classified as a narcotic, a drug that dulls the senses. Whatever means is used, to consume opium regularly, in any form, is to risk forging an almost unbreakable and deadly bond. Because opium is one of the most addictive and debilitating substances on earth, the opium addict, the person dependent upon or habituated to opium, has been called slave, fiend, and ghost. Smoking was introduced to the West in the 1850s, a habit brought from China by European travelers and sailors, and Chinese immigrants. Veiled by an unrivaled aura of Eastern decadence, it appealed to those with an artistic temperament in Europe and to degenerates in North America. Adopted on the one hand by writers, artists, and the wealthy, who seem to have little better to do with their time and money than squander it on bad habits, and on the other by sailors, prostitutes, and drifters who seem to have nothing but bad habits, opium smoking was relegated to society's fringes. And, as if opium wasn't enough, cocaine, ether, hashish, chloroform, and absinthe also became popular around the same time. In fact, the consumption of all drugs in all forms remained legal until the early 20th century, when countries around the world began to realize how damaging they were to health and productivity. Warnings about the dangers of drug use surfaced now and again, and many countries did have laws that restricted drug traffic across borders, but these were in place mainly to collect tax revenues and protect pharmacists. Novelists and poets elevated opium in all of its incarnations to the status of a muse, crediting it for releasing them from the tedium of banal thoughts and words. Brilliant writers, able to free themselves from inhibition, shone, Dull ones at least had new experiences to write about. Travelers wove opium experiences into their accounts, adding even more spice and danger to already captivating tales. Cinema also exploited the drug craze, with films like The Derelict, The Dividend, Broken Blossoms, Bits of Life, and Human Wreckage, rushing in to show the evil influences of unsavory foreign immigrants or the unscrupulous morphine-wielding medical profession. Hollywood knew it was onto a good thing and cashed in on the box office draw of drugs. Even anti-opium crusaders were caught up in the drug's exotic web, reveling in sordid tales of seduction and white slavery, and emphasizing details that were sure to titillate the public and fuel the flames of their cause. As a consequence, opium smuggling and drug use became favorite themes in detective novels and true crime exposés. Much of the imagery reflects the prejudice and bigotry of the time. The history of drugs is convoluted, and written references to them are both fascinating and infinite. After a tour of San Francisco's Chinatown, Rudyard Kipling commented that the buildings he saw there were constructed on the lines of icebergs, two-thirds below side level. That's precisely what I've discovered about the world of opium. It is rich, complex, and pervasive. And this is but the tip of the iceberg. Magic comes from morphine. The principal active ingredient in opium, morphine is an alkaloid, an organic compound, many of which have toxic, stimulant, or analgesic effects. Friedrich Wilhelm Saturner isolated morphine and published his results in 1805, describing the substance as the principium somniferum, or the sleep-making principle, and naming it morphium. Of the 30 or so other alkaloids in opium, codeine is the most important. Morphine, pure and strong, unlike raw opium, burst onto the drug scene on the heels of the invention of the functional hypodermic needle by Dr. Alexander Wood in 1853. Although morphine could be taken orally, experimenters noticed that the response to injecting it under the skin was far more rapid. As narcotics, opium, morphine, and heroin are drugs that relieve pain, relax spasms, reduce fevers, and induce sleep. Acting as an analgesic, or pain reliever, the morphine blocks messages of pain to the brain, producing euphoria and deadening anxieties and tensions. It also suppresses coughs, slows down respiration, and dilates the blood vessels in the skin. All of these characteristics are invaluable in medicine, not to cure specific illnesses or injuries, but to provide relief from symptoms. Taken in the wrong quantities, however, the relief can turn injurious or fatal. Heroin. A semi-synthetic substance derived from morphine by simple structural modification was first created in the 1870s, shelved, and then rediscovered in 1898 by Heinrich Dreiser, a chemist for the Bayer Company of Germany. Heroin was initially marketed as a remedy for tuberculosis, laryngitis, and coughs. It was also, ironically, touted as a potential cure for morphine addiction.
Nobody has the answer. And here they were telling me that dope addiction could change my life. Well, I didn't know what they were talking about, but it sure sounded good. I looked at what I had on one hand. I had plenty of God's only begotten Son, but there was such an emptiness in my heart. I just couldn't find the answer. And here they were telling me that the answer was in cigarettes, booze, Cadillac cars, and on and on and on. Not only were they showing me this from the Bible and telling me all about it, but I began to notice that these dope fiends really had something in their lives. They had something real.
Slow down, little man. You've grown tired of grass, LSD, acid, cocaine, and hash, and someone pretending to be a true friend. Said, I'll introduce you to Miss Heroin. Will be mine until death do us part. So now, little man.
Timothy Leary used to distinguish between life drugs like pot and psychedelics and death drugs like heroin and coke. The romance of Hip attaches mostly to the latter. At its purest, this story is about heroin.
At the top of the drug ladder, heroin is a perfect commodity, exhausting the resources of its users while eliminating the need for other commodities. Users reinvent themselves in its image. After all, what is an addict but someone who has become an adjunct to his product, rather than the other way around? As a metaphor, dope captures the hip universe in a glassine packet, branded to find its target market. Body bag, Hellraiser, homicide, poison, no way out. What hip shares with drugs, as Burroughs hints at, is a capacity for organizing time, removing it from the forward thrust of the straight world. Both shape it to their own rhythm. Though psychoactive substances have been around for millennia, what we refer to as the drug culture and hip both arise in response to the modern problem of time. As Burroughs put it, junkies run on junk time and junk metabolism. They are subject to junk climate. They are warmed and chilled by junk. The kick of junk is living under junk conditions. This rhythm shields users from any concerns outside itself. Drugs trump other claims on time by colonizing it for their own needs. Drug time, as Burroughs said, can be pleasant or unpleasant, but it provides reliable shelter from the future. Whatever happens tomorrow, it won't happen to you. Similarly, junk time makes the past irrelevant. Your identity reflects not the accidents that got you here, but the substances that are on the market at any given moment. Drug trends ebb and flow with the rhythms of the economy. Coke in a fast market to keep up with time, dope in a slow one to fill the hours. Ecstasy served the binge economy of the 1980s and 90s, which alternated long hours of intense focus during the work week with long hours of focused rave. But at either speed, the promise of drugs is more time, not less.
Oh,
yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, fellow Americans, lady Americans, this is James Brown. I want to talk to you about one of our most deadly killers in the country today. I had a dream the other night and I was sitting in my living room. I dozed off to sleep, so I started dreaming. I dream I walked in a place and I saw a real strange, weird object standing up talking to the people. And I found out it was Harold.
Get your mind together and deal with them drugs. That's the man.
Lou Reed used to wonder that people thought the Velvet Underground song Heroin glamorized the drug. He wrote the song as a neutral exploration
to exorcise the darkness or the self-destructive element in me.
It was not meant to be fun.
Heroin is very close to the feeling you get from smack,
he said.
It starts on a certain level. It's deceptive. You think you're enjoying it, but by the time it hits you, it's too late. You don't have any choice. It comes at you harder and faster and keeps on coming. The song is everything that the real thing is doing to you.
No cultural artifact has accrued more hip cachet than the first Velvet Underground album, with Heroin as its centerpiece. In an era when musicians made coy references to weed or acid, Heroin introduced a starker vocabulary. The spike going in the vein, the blood shooting up the dropper's neck, the latter a reference to the register that tells a user he's in a vein. Heroin begins with single strokes on the guitar, not quite marking time. Reed's voice enters before the full band, stating the problem, which is not drugs, but life.
I just don't know where I'm going.
As the first verse gathers momentum, the music rises around the words, cranking and stopping on the screech of Cale's viola and Maureen Tucker's no-breaks tom-toms. The sound grows denser as it accelerates, compressing time into ever shorter measures. The verbs are gerunds, arrested in mid-action. Lou is rushing on my run. He's closing in on death. From any point in the song, you sense that things are only going to get worse. Then, rather than build this rush to a crescendo, closing all the way in on death, the musicians abruptly stop, leaving the hangover of feedback and distorted time. The result calls to mind the use of stop time in jazz, in which the rhythm section drops out and a soloist keeps flying. But the effect of Heroin is wholly different. Jazz stop time calls attention to the underlying pulse, which holds the music together even without anyone playing it. It's just there. The stops in Heroin, on the other hand, show how unmoored time has been all along. Like Twain's River or Kerouac's Open Road, which restart the action at each bend, Heroin interrupts the sequence of cause and effect, building to climaxes that never come. When Lou starts to look backward, wishing he was born 1,000 years ago, sailing in a great big clipper ship, wearing a sailor suit and cap, the lyrics don't quite register. They're part of the distortion and feedback, like random noise, and as images, they're a little silly, unless you want to market a maritime Lou action figure. Ignored upon its release, the song became the seminal no that launched 1,000 indie bands, and in its message, the yes that launched 1,000 nods. Ah!
Well, I was in the car and I heard this guy. He sounded all shook up and he told me why. His voice was a shaking on the E.I.
I blame Hillary Clinton. She's the reason for all this. I should have stuck with tequila.
New figures show that OxyContin use by 12th graders is up 40% in just 3 years. OxyContin is an effective medication for severe pain, but when abused, it can be as addictive as heroin. More than 1 in 20 high school seniors acknowledge taking OxyContin.
Ryan is a 17-year-old high school senior from Tewksbury, Massachusetts. He says just a week after he started using OxyContin, he realized that if he didn't get a pill every day or two, he'd start to feel kind of sick. All the teenagers we spoke with for this story said they knew at least one young person who had overdosed and died recently either on OxyContin or on heroin.
Okay, am I the only person who finds this just a little bit hard to believe? I mean, $80 a pill? $80? And everyone knows somebody who died from an overdose? If so many young people are dying from overdosing on this drug, then why is the subway still so crowded every morning? Smell hyperbole.
I got you, man. OxyContin, Xanax, bars, Percocets, and Lorotabs. Values, morphine, patches, ecstasy, and it's all up for grabs. What you want, what you need, hit me up, I got you, man. What you want, what you need, hit me up, I got you, man.
San Francisco's Chinatown was established after the arrival of the first Chinese newcomers in 1849 and 1850, and opium soon followed. According to Richard Dillon, author of The Hatchet Men, 1864 was, for San Francisco, the year of opium, marked by the arrival of the first large shipment of opium on the Derby. Customs officials found this one, but from then on were helpless against the sheer volume of opium that moved through San Francisco's port. The drug was legal but subject to heavy import taxes, so successful smuggling maximized profits. Tours of San Francisco's opium dens became a must, attracting writers like Rudyard Kipling and Mark Twain. Twain took great pleasure in writing that
the stewing and frying of the drug and the gurgling of the juices in the stem would well nigh turn the stomach of a statue.
New York's Chinatown, established possibly as early as 1858, but more likely by 1876, was perhaps more than that of any other North American city, dogged by its reputation as a center for crime. As with other Chinatowns, it attracted its fair share of attention from police, journalists, and crusaders. H.H. Kane wrote in 1881 that opium smoking came to New York in 1876, around the same time, he claimed, that it arrived in Chicago, St. Louis, and New Orleans. Coinciding with the Chinese migration from the West Coast. His investigations of New York dens revealed Chinatown streets that were
swarming with Chinamen, Malays, and half-breeds in a mixed tenement house population.
Louis J. Beck, in his book New York's Chinatown, considered it better to get yellow fever than the opium-smoking habit. He described a visit to a den on West 46th Street that, at one time,
was the most luxuriously furnished joint, not only in New York, but in the United States.
What distinguished this particular den was its size and location, close to the heart of busy Broadway. It took up an entire three-story house. Heavy curtains shield any view of the interior, though, according to Beck,
the furniture of the rooms was very simple. There wasn't any.
Along with the scarlet-dyed mats scattered about, the rooms were
so thickly strewn with men and women that you could with difficulty make your way through the tangled feet and lengths. Wallowing is the predominant posture of the opium smoker. A couch of any kind seems to be beyond his ambition.
Thank you. pasture like sun. Lays me down with my mind, she runs throughout the night. No need to fight.
Started when I was 17. A friend of mine broke his foot and was prescribed Vicodin 5-500s. I was passing him in the hall and he just handed me two, so I put them in my pocket, not really sure what to do with them, not knowing what they were. After all, it was 1997 and the drug really hadn't gained much popularity around here. So I waited about a week, still unsure about taking them. So late one night, I popped them. Soon, I felt those magical, euphoric opiate effects come over me. I waited for good old mom to go to bed and got my guitar and watched Lynyrd Skynyrd's Behind the Music, noting it was much more interesting than usual. I absolutely loved this brand new feeling. Better than weed, I thought, and much harder to get caught with. I was happy, happier than I'd been in quite some time. Well, needless to say, I wanted more. I realized my mom was getting some painkiller called Darvocet. I thought, maybe since it's a prescribed painkiller, it will have the same effects. Sure enough, it did, and I was back in euphoria land. I began doing them every night. For years, I reserved it as a nighttime social drug, and it allowed me to be myself, to talk intelligently and extensively about anything with anybody. Then, about 3 years into my habit, it got really bad. I was taking them as soon as I got up, then all throughout the day. By this time, I had dropped out of school, and Grandma, who lived with us, was also getting a steady script. I was numb most of the time for about 2 years, during which my family had caught on and began hiding them, although I could always find them. I no longer felt normal without Darvocet. My tolerance was rising, and I generally needed 5 to 8 100-650 pills to get even close to the feeling I wanted, and needed for that matter. I was getting worried, too. Then, about a year ago, my mother started getting 7.5-750 hydrocodone tablets. I immediately established a consistent routine of 1.5 to 2 on the way to work, 1 at 10 o'clock break, 2 more at lunch, and any given number after work depending on how many I had and how many I could steal. Soon I began having trouble getting up for work, but was ready to go as soon as I had taken my combination. Then my performance started slacking. I didn't even want to be at work usually and would frequently leave early. I eventually quit the job. I kept taking whatever I could get, Vicoprofen, T3s, Percocet, OxyContin, whatever was there. Not being able to score left me very mad and extremely miserable. I was getting very tired of this roller coaster and decided I would be a lot better off to just quit, so I did. My girlfriend was there for me the whole time, and I took a lot of hot baths, which really helped because I got so many chills. I was always getting cold during withdrawals, not to mention the miserable aches and pains, etc. It was absolutely the worst week of my life. I still keep a reserve of T3s and hydrocodone for partying and when my pain gets too bad. I'm only 22. My advice is, don't get addicted in the first place. Learn from this story. I didn't wreck my life, but I came awfully close. I hope my little bit of info on how I quit helps some people. I know how horribly hard it is to quit. Some people may need rehab. Please, please, don't be like me and keep a reserve of pills after you quit if you think it will cause you to slip back into the habit. I'm a different person now, and with help, I can control when I want to take them. Please learn from this story. Stick to popping them once in a while to relax or party, but only if you have to.
Experiment. Thank you for listening and tune in next week. This is Ed Chef signing off.
You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WXHD Mount Hope, and WFMU.org.